Hello there, this is Chris Scullion, games journalist and author of some extremely top quality gaming encyclopedias, it says here. You're listening to What's Wrong with Wolfie, the only 90s podcast that takes it to the max. It is both fat and dope in equal measure.
Welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie. My name is Jason.
And I'm Rich.
And I'm Chris.
And this time, it's all about the horror. I have a funny history with horror films. I never seek them out, always choosing a different genre to watch. But if I was to watch one, the majority of the time, I would probably end up enjoying it. I can't ever go too disgusting. I can't see the appeal of watching something that's been grotesque just because they can. But thankfully there are plenty of horror films out there trying to tell a story in a much cleverer way, and this special episode we have three fine examples of those, chosen by a very special guest. So please welcome to the pod the man whose words I always looked out for in the official Nintendo magazine, the man who turned out the lights on CVG magazine, and is now a games journalist for VGC, and very successful author to three gaming encyclopedias, with more on the way, is none other than Chris Scullion. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you went on beyond me turning the lights out on CVG, because that's...
I was going to say, why did you do that, Chris? Why?
I should stress that it wasn't by choice. Basically, every publication I've ever worked on, present one excluded, has been shut down. I should stress that's not my fault. I was on CVG when it ended, so I was kind of, and just the way the holidays worked out, I was like the last person there when it ended. So yeah, the end of an era, and I was the idiot who was there at the end of it.
Must have been quite surreal for you, wasn't it?
It really was, because I obviously grew up reading games magazines and stuff my entire life, and that was always what I wanted to do as a job, and CVG was one of it's one of the few magazines that was older than me, because it came out in 1981. That's when it started. Yeah. And I've read that all my life, so the dream was always to eventually write for CVG.
Yeah,
but the dream was not to close it down. And that's ultimately what ended up happening. So yeah, it's a bit weird to kind of be the one definitely to like turn the lights off on the thing that you grew up reading. That was a bit a strange day.
I hope Andy Robinson's not like sweating too much, that it might, you know, the curse might happen again for VGC.
Hopefully, fingers crossed. VGC's, which definitely has nothing to do with CVG. That's a complete coincidence, the initials. We're doing well, thankfully. So hopefully, yeah. But basically, VGC's given us the chance to carry out the plan that was the plan with CVG back in the day when we kind of took over when Andy took over CVG. It was quite tabloidy in nature. Yeah. Lots of kind of reviews at E3 booth babes and all this kind of stuff. Aww. And we'd kind of tried to turn it into a straight news site, but by that point it was maybe a wee bit too late, and Future had already decided it was going to go ahead with Games Radar, so we were kind of, our kind of number was up. So VGC is our kind of chance to do what we were going to do with CVG and kind of grow as a straight news site, and it seems to be going well so far, which is good.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of my go-to places for video game news.
Awesome, thank you.
And it's nice to go to somewhere where it's quite fairly based.
It's a kind of skill to learn to write these things without resisting the urge to throw in the odd wee opinion or the odd, well, that's a bit rubbish. But yeah, I think like you say, it's good because it appeals to every audience, every kind of demographic and such. You don't want to kind of take sides on these things, because that's how you lose readers, basically.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously we have a slight issue with this episode because we have two Chrises on the show. So obviously I'm not going to change your name, Chris Scullion. So
thank you.
We need to change our Chris's name. And, you know, I tried to think of something that we could do, but, you know, like calling him Other Chris or Chris the First or...
Guy Incognito, there you go.
Ensign Ricky.
Ensign Chris.
I could call you Ensign Ricky. Chris. Ensign Ricky.
Red shirt Chris, there you go.
The red shirt who dies in Family Guy.
All right. We'll call you Instant Ricky from now on, shall we?
You're living out your dream, Chris. You're living out your dream.
Oh, God, I don't even know where that came from.
So, Chris, it's Instant Ricky. Cool. Oh. Get it right, Rich.
So, I've got to say, oh, crap, every time you talk to me.
Yes. So, we touched upon some of the work that you've done in the past, Chris. But if anyone's listening that doesn't know all that you do at the moment, let them know now.
Oh, God. How long is this podcast? okay, well, basically, in my day job, I'm the features editor for VGC, VideoGamesChronicle.com. As my second job, I'm the writer of a bunch of video game encyclopedias. So I've done the NES Encyclopedia, SNES Encyclopedia, Mega Drive Encyclopedia, the N64 Encyclopedia is out this year. I'm currently working on the Dreamcast Encyclopedia. And then in the future, I announced it last week that I'll then be doing Game Boy and Game Boy Color, then PlayStation, then GameCube and Wii U Encyclopedias. And I've got a daughter. That's the third job. And yeah, that's pretty much it. And then in my spare time, I sleep.
Some point
of hours a day.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
It's usually crashed on the couch.
And you mentioned about your encyclopedias, and they are a wonderful resource to have in the collection, and just a good book to sit down and flick through and read about some of the games that came out on on these systems.
But yeah, they're fun to write, but they're pretty intense processes.
I can imagine, yeah. But I mean, how did they come to be? I mean, how did it all start for you with that? Well,
it's funny because I'd always wanted to, like, even when I was at Official Nintendo Magazine, anytime we'd come up with ideas for free gifts, I would always pipe up and say, why don't we do an encyclopedia of something? And the editors would always say, no, that takes too long. And you go, oh, and they were right. At one point when CVG closed and I went freelance for a while, I was sitting there thinking, well, I need to do something because I got a kind of grown-up job. I was working for the Scottish Government for a while, and I was like, this is boring. I need to kind of do something. I thought, well, I'll try and write a book. And it took me ages to actually find someone who wanted the book, but one day I just tweeted and said, how do you get a book done? And luckily the guy who worked for the publisher just followed me, and he said, well, send me what you want to do. And it was inspired by there was a magazine that CVG used to do called The Complete Guide to Consoles, and there was one in the 80s, and it started in like 88 89, and they did like four issues, and they were big thick special magazines, and they basically had every game in them released at the time, and I was obsessed with these magazines, like that wore them out like constantly, and I thought I'd love to do a modern version of those with like a book just about one console and all its games. So I started with the NES because that was the first console that I kind of fell in love with in the first place, and they just kind of continued from there. The plan was to do one book, but it did well enough that the publisher said, do you want to do another one? I was like, yeah. And then it was just kind of we're at the point now where just as long as people keep buying them, we're going to keep doing them. Like, we've got 8 contracted, and if they keep going, we'll just keep going until either I die or people stop buying them.
Or you just run out of systems to cover.
Yeah. That's like, well, I'm hoping to die before I get to the Switch. Like, it's not nice to hope you're going to die, but if the choice is death or covering the entire Switch library, I mean, I'll pay for the coffin.
Yeah, I can imagine that'd be quite a challenge. I mean, you mentioned about the PlayStation one that you're planning on doing. I mean, that in itself is going to be quite a challenge, is it not?
Yeah, it's going to be ridiculous. I mean, because when I first started doing them, a lot of people on Twitter were saying, oh, you should do a PlayStation one, ha, ha, ha. And I went, ha, 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 and then thought, actually, because I'm an idiot and I'm not very good at kind of dismissing things. And we kind of, the publisher and me and the publisher kind of joked about it for the last couple of years. And then one day I thought, actually, this might be doable. And I looked at the Mega Drive Encyclopedia had like 990 games in it, because it covered the Mega Drive and the Mega CD and the 32X in one book. And I looked at the PlayStation library in the West, it's like something like 1,700 games. Jesus. And I thought, if I take twice as long to write this, technically it's doable because it's less than twice as many games. So that's what we're doing. Usually it takes me a year to write these books, so I'm going to take 2 years to write the PlayStation one. And we're kind of discussing the format just now. It's either going to be two volumes, but ideally I'd like it to be one big 500-page book that would just be an absolute beast. So that's the that's the provisional plan. But we've got a couple of years before we have to worry about the layout. But yeah.
I think by the time you're done with that, you're going to be done with the PlayStation, I think.
Yeah, very much. But the worrying thing is it's also a kind of a test run for other consoles that have got big libraries. So if it does well, I'll be like, oh no, now I can do PlayStation 2 or the Wii or something else that's got like more than 1,000 games in its library, and that just opens up a whole new world of hell. Yeah. I mean, I say that I do still enjoy doing it. To be fair, I would have just given up by now if it was too much. When it stops being fun, I'll pack it in. But I'm still enjoying playing through all these games.
Yeah, what is it like to do that? To sit down and just play through a whole system library in such a short space of time?
It's difficult. I mean, it's good that. The good thing about it being an encyclopedia and not like a book of reviews is that I don't need to play through them all from start to finish, because that would be impossible. Luckily, for each game, I just play a couple of hours just enough until I kind of get a feel for what it is, and to the extent that I can write it up. And then there's loads of good online resources like old manuals and magazine articles and stuff that you can use to get a kind of a grasp on what the reaction was at the time. But it's weird when you play through an entire console's library in the course of a year, you get a really good feel for that console and what the kind of state of the market was like at that point. So like when you're playing through the SNES library, you're going, oh, there was lots of, you see the sheer amount of American sports games and all the kind of licensed movie tie-ins and stuff. And then when you get to the N64, you suddenly go, wow. This wasn't a great period. Like, I love the N64. Oh.
I didn't say you're wrong.
N64 is one of my favourite consoles, to be clear. But when you go from the SNES to the N64 and suddenly the frame rate plummets, the average frame rate plummets, so many bloody games and stuff, and you're like, I used to adore this thing, and it doesn't hold up massively well. And now that I'm doing the Dreamcast book, like the difference is night and day. Oh. Like I was saying recently, I think that the jump from N64 to Dreamcast, that kind of PlayStation N64 era to the Dreamcast, I think was one of the biggest jumps in gaming, because when you instantly go to VGA quality and 60 frames a second on most games and stuff, it's like I'm having so much more, not more fun, but it's easier to write the Dreamcast book because the games are more approachable, like in 2022. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to kind of, when you play through them all, you get a good kind of feeling in your head. Especially with the N64 book, I covered all the Japanese games as well.
Yeah.
And it lets you see like the change in the difference in culture between the West and Japan, because one minute I'm writing through all the Western books and it's all sports games and stuff, then you jump into Japan and it's nothing but Mahjong games and baseball games, like as far as the eye can see, and you're like, right, okay, this is Japan then. So it's fun. It's an interesting way of doing it, because it does really kind of let me see these consoles in a new light. So that was a really long answer.
That is cool, man. I guess it, like from a little personal achievement, really, isn't it? Like, I don't think a lot of people will be able to turn around and say, I've played every single game on all of these systems, even if it's just for half an hour chunks, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, that's, I think, part of my nature is I'm this really obsessive, like, collectathon type person. So that's why, like, I'm obsessed with Xbox achievements and all this kind of stuff. So it's just my nature to collect things. Like, I've got a big, massive Amiibo collection. I collected every Disney Infinity toy, every Lego Dimensions toy. So it's the perfect book for my kind of nature, because it lets me tick another thing off and say, right, that's one.
Yep.
It's ideal for me. It kind of feeds that nagging in my brain. It's supposed to do something.
That nagging that most video gamers have in their brain.
Yeah, exactly.
And just wanted to touch on your platforming-based book that you've got coming out soon. What can you tell us about that? And is there a plan for more of these type of books in the future?
No. I mean, there was. The original plan was the publisher spoke to me at one point and said we want to do a book about platform games, and make it like a series about different genres of games and start with platforming. And I was saying, oh, I can do that. And he's like, you sure? You've kind of got enough on your plate. I was like, yeah, that'll be fine. Like, not realizing. And then, so yeah, I said, yeah, I'll take it on. So the book's called Jumping for Joy, and it's like the history of platform games. So it's split into three sections. So the first section is every Mario platformer ever made. The second one is every Sonic platformer ever made. And then at the back, there's this big 100-page section dedicated to like 50 other kind of important and iconic platformers over the years. So the hope is that it's like this, by the end of it, it's just like this big massive love letter to platformers. And it was then going to be followed by a racing game one, and then a beat 'em up one, and a one-on-one fighting game one. But it got to the point where if I was going to do the encyclopedias as well, I would have to spend 6 months to do a full encyclopedia to make space for those books, and that's just impossible. Mm. Like the year I did Jumping for Joy, I also did the N64 encyclopedia, and that was like two massive books in 1 year, and I was just done by the end of it. And I just said to the publisher, look, I can't do this. Yeah. I finally found my limit. And then, so yeah, so it was a good idea in theory, but I've only got two hands, so decided to to just kind of leave it at that. Yeah. But hopefully it does well. I'm really happy with it. I'm really proud of it, and I'm hopeful that it'll be a nice, especially the bit at the back, I'm hoping that'll be a nice kind of checklist for people, either people who want to get into the genre for the first time or who love platform games and want to kind of to, again, that kind of collector's urge to be able to say they've ticked off all 50 games in the book and played through them. I'm hoping some people kind of take that mission on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy that you chose platforming for your first one of these type of books, and now it's only going to be the only type of book that you do with this, but platforming being one of my favourite genres of video games as well, and Sonic and Mario, obviously, two of my all-time favourite video game characters. So,
yeah.
And with the other games that you've included in the book as well, yeah, I'm really excited for this one. So when does that come out?
That comes out, what is it now, April? It's out in May. It's at the end of next month, so... Yeah, it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to people shouting abuse at me, because some of the games I've chosen for the 50 platformers at the back, I've tried to make it like interesting to read, and so which I suppose is a good thing for most books. So I've not just gone for like the 50 best platformers, because I think that'd be quite boring. So I've deliberately gone for like kind of as wide a range of games as I can, so I can say, look, obviously you've got like Pitfall in there as the first, and Manic Miner and the kind of older ones, and then you've got modern stuff like It Takes Two, but then somewhere in the middle, like there's Tomb Raiders in there, and I can say, look, say what you like, but the first one was a platformer, like All Night Long, and stuff like Trials, you can say, look, Trials is a platformer, it just happens that you're on a bike, so stuff like that, I'm sure we'll get some interesting discussion going, I would hope. But sure. I stand by it.
I'm sure you've grown quite a thick skin over the years. Oh, so
yeah, definitely.
Well, that's fantastic stuff. I know, like I said, excited to get my hands on the N64 Encyclopedia and the Jumping for Joy book. So please go and check out Chris's books on the Pen and Sword website, or just on all good book places, really.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You know, what we're going to do on this episode, we are going to talk about some horror films. Chris has picked three of his favourite horror films from the 1990s. But before we jump into those picks, we feel like we've got to know you, Chris, quite well. But I feel like we need to get to know you just a little bit better before we jump into your horror picks.
That's so understandable.
I've got 10 would you rather questions that I'm going to quick fire at you just to get to know you a little bit better. If you're ready, that's what I'm going to do to you right now.
Great, brilliant. Bring on.
Let's start with, would you rather wear winter clothes all summer or summer clothes all winter?
Let me think. I know what the answer is. I just need to think in my head because I'm just trying to take that, like deconstruct that. Basically, I would rather freeze than melt. So that would mean summer clothes in winter. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'd rather wear summer clothes in winter, please.
Would you rather play Super Mario 3 or Super Mario World?
3.
Would you rather talk like Yoda or breathe like Darth Vader for the rest of your life?
Well, I almost do breathe like Darth Vader, so
that's what Rich said in the last episode.
I'll take that because that involves the least adjustment.
Would you rather play Jet Set Radio or Crazy Taxi?
I'd rather play Crazy Taxi while listening to the Jet Set Radio soundtrack.
Nice.
Good answer. Would you rather have a hamster full bath or a snail shower?
What was the first one?
A hamster filled bath or a snail shower.
Snail shower. I used to have a hamster and it bit me in the finger once. So at least snails can't bite, so I'll go with that.
Would you rather watch the Super Mario Bros. Film or the Street Fighter film?
Street Fighter, all day long.
Would you rather live twice as long or win the lottery?
Live twice as long.
Would you rather spend the night camping or at a luxury hotel?
Luxury hotel.
Would you rather have to sing everything you want to say or talk in rhyme?
I would rather probably talk in rhyme, as long as I have to do it all the time.
And don't write your books in rhyme either. That would just be really annoying.
Oh, no, that would be just hard enough.
And the last one, would you rather watch Babylon 5 or Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
See, this is a sore subject for me because I started a Star Trek website because I've never seen either. So I'll say Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, and because I hope to one day watch it. I started a website called Star Trek Virgin like 10 years ago because the idea was that I'd never seen a single episode of Star Trek at the time. And I thought, well, I'm going to do a website chronicling it and watch everything, all Star Trek, and got like 6 episodes in and gave up.
Life gets in the way.
It does.
It's a great idea, though.
I like those 6 episodes. It's still up there. I will get round to it. It's StarTrekVirgin.com. Those 6 episodes are reviewed there still. I got as far as the one where there's like some kind of space pimp. Captain Kirk's like, what's going on here? He's like, I'm a space pimp. He doesn't say he's a space pimp. He pretends to be somebody else. But it turns out always he's a space pimp.
Space pimp.
Sure, this wasn't a porn parody because it sounds like
it. I can't remember. Let me just look it up because it's going to annoy me now. It was in the original series.
I know the original series quite well, but I'm trying to place.
It was called Mudd's Woman.
Oh, so yeah, Harry Mudd.
I've described it as.
With his android women.
That's it. So I've described it as a space pimp tries to use his trio of lovely ladies to seduce the Enterprise's crew, but there's more to them than meets the eye.
Yeah.
So yeah. So I got as far as that and then thought, that'll do. But I definitely want to keep going. It was just finding the time. But I remember one thing that stuck with me from that episode is that his ladies had some sort of magic about them or some sort of space nonsense where they were actually ugly, but they looked pretty to the people who saw them.
Yeah.
And to make them look ugly in the show, they just took their makeup off.
Yeah. And then to make them pretty, they put the old classic Vaseline filter on the lens.
Exactly.
And softens like, them a little bit, a bit of a halo.
It's like they're all like kind of dolly birds and all going, oh, hello, and everyone's, oh, and then suddenly they turn around and they just don't have their makeup on, and Kirk's like, Jesus!
Like, Roddenberry is always very progressive, you know, given
oh,
that.
Oh, God.
you need to get back to that, Chris. You need to get back to that, mate.
I definitely will.
I'd love to read your opinions on the third series, especially Spock's Brain.
Nice. I definitely will. The aim was to turn it into a book.
Oh, really?
back in the day when I wasn't writing books all the time, almost like a kind of episode guide from the point of view of someone who didn't know what they were talking about. but yeah, we'll see. I'll catch up. I've to be fair, I've stuck to the original plan. I haven't watched any Star Trek since, so I technically still am. Those 6 episodes are still all I've seen of Star Trek. I think I will. Yeah. Sorry, that was the longest quickfire answer.
It was cool, but we all know now what you're going to be getting up to after you have done with the encyclopedias. So.
Yeah, on some 70.
Yeah. Okay, right, on to our topic for the show. We asked Chris, like I said, to choose 3 of his favourite horror films of the 90s, and he has come up with 3 very cool films. All of these are on streaming services, so if you fancy watching any after listening to this, then they are easily accessible. So Chris, please let us know what your first pick is.
Gladly. Well, my first film, which I believe is available on Netflix at the time of writing, at the time of recording, is The Blair Witch Project, which just about squeaks in as a 90s movie.
This is my home, which I am leaving the comforts of for the weekend to explore the Blair Witch.
I can see you.
I'm real excited about this. Thank you for
the
opportunity.
I'm very glad.
This area's been haunted by that old woman for years.
I don't know why you have to have every conversation on video.
Because we're making a documentary.
Not about us getting lost. We're making a documentary about a witch.
I don't.
We're lost. Admit that first.
No, I know we're not lost.
They're all over the place.
But how do we know it was people?
Well, even if it wasn't, I'm not going to play with that either.
And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted. Just want to apologize to Mike's mom and Josh's mom and my mom.
Tell me where you are, Josh!
So, why this film?
It was one of those films where it's rare that a film is like a phenomenon like The Blair Witch Project was. And at the time, it came at that perfect moment, this perfect kind of time where the internet was new enough that things could spread in a viral nature, but also the internet was also new enough that people weren't cynical of everything, like from start to finish. Like if they tried to do the Blair Witch Project now, it would be exposed as a fake within 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Because people would find the Twitter accounts of the people that were in it and say, oh, they're not really dead. Here they are now. They're on Instagram on holiday. it was that perfect, the perfect storm of everyone going, is this real? This feels pretty real. I think this is real. And they did like a documentary before it in America about like just playing it totally straight, as if here's a documentary about the history of the town of Burkittsville and what happened to these kids who went missing. And so when you see it, it's one of those ones you never forget seeing it for the first time, because it's absolutely terrifying the first time, but for me at least. And obviously every subsequent time you watch it, it's not scary at all once you realise that nothing actually happens. But that first kind of, especially if you watch it with a good enough sound system or if you wear headphones with it, the moments when they're like, they're in the tent and you can hear like kids laughing outside the tent.
Oh, that bit. Oh my God.
It's just absolutely terrifying. Yeah, so I loved it. I when it came out, I got massively obsessed with it. I bought like all the books about it and read all the kind of all the articles about it, and was obsessed with the websites and stuff, and like bought all the PC games and stuff like that. So yeah, Blair Witch Project is like, yeah, it was an obsession of mine for a wee while.
Rich, have you seen this film?
Oh yeah, many times. Yeah, I mean, very much on what Chris said. I think what really struck me about this film at the time, yeah, it obviously benefited from the internet, but I think the internet was still young enough that you felt like it was still, word was still being spread via whispers and people talking about it. It was just something you wouldn't get nowadays, because it is all online, it is all cynical. But at the time, it almost reminded me, when I was growing up, my parents would talk about like when The Exorcist came out, and they'll talk about like ambulances being outside the cinema, people were fainting. I think this was like the first, in many ways, probably the only time in my lifetime that there was a film that came out that had that kind of like aura, that kind of energy about it. It felt almost kind of, not taboo is the wrong way of putting it, but it just felt like there was this feeling of dread, and you didn't quite know what it was and if it was real, if it wasn't. I think it was just a perfect product at a perfect time, and it is still pretty damn terrifying. I mean, even though we know everything about it now, we know the fact, we know the fiction, you know, I saw the actress, Heather Donahue, I saw her in an episode of I think it was actually It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And then it's like, it didn't shatter the illusion for me. I thought, oh, look, it's Heather. But I can still go back and watch Blair Witch. I'm like, yep, she's dead. This is horrifying. But
the Scott Bakula episode of It's Always Sunny wasn't jarring then.
No, not at all.
That was just genius.
Yeah.
But sorry, let's go.
It's the visuals of it, the sound, it's just a perfect horror. from the snapping of twigs. You've got, I don't know what the sounds were they used in the promotion, but you hear it during the end credits as well. It's almost like thudding, kind of like metal drum kind of sounds.
Yeah.
And it has that kind of feel, like what you get with like Texas Chainsaw Massacre with like the flashbulbs. It just has this really chilling, just it's just, I can't put into words how beautifully it's executed in terms of visuals and sound. It just stays with you. Not just the film itself, but yeah, the promotion as well. Anytime you saw like just little clips of where they're running and Heather's screaming, yeah, what the fuck is that? What the fuck is that? And the camera's kind of all over the place. And you think you're seeing something, even though you know you're not. Mm-hmm. And that to me is just not just perfect horror, but perfect filmmaking. Like when you're filling in the blanks, mm-hmm. that is just mm-hmm. perfect, in my opinion.
And I think what made it perfect was that they were filling in the blanks at the same time. Like when you read about how they made it, like they were told very little about what was. They basically were given little notes like every night. So one guy was, I think it was Josh, or I can't remember if it was Josh, who basically told, you drop the map today. And that was it. And the other two don't get told that. So when he loses the map, they legitimately think he's lost the map. And when they're playing the stuff in the speakers at night, they're reacting to it legitimately because they don't know what's going on. So it's real terror. And you can't fake that. Like you can't, as good as, you can be the best actor in the world, but you can't make terror look as good as actual real terror. And even stuff like that famous shot, like when she faces the camera and it's like looking up her nose, was like totally accidental. She meant to get her full face in the frame and just messed up, and that just made it more legitimate because it didn't look like a perfectly framed Hollywood movie.
Yeah,
it looked kind of,
it was just off kilter, it was off frame.
Yeah.
And you've got that empty space past her face as well, so you're almost looking towards what's behind her. You're looking to see if something's there, and that is just there.
And that's exactly what Rich said. And most of your reality is an illusion. Your brain fills in the gaps instinctively. Mm-hmm. And by replicating that in an entertainment medium comes along very rarely. Mm. Yeah. Alien did it successfully in 79, where you barely see it.
Yeah.
It's all working on your instincts. And some of the most best TV shows and films are written by people who understand your inherent instinct fears mm-hmm. of the dark, the unknown, sound, disembodied sounds. You can't see it, but you can hear it. And also, I just want to touch on the it's a very similar trope where you can hire a bad singer, right? And it's much the same way as the film. You can create a ropey looking found footage film in the same way. You can get someone to sing, but you can't get a good singer to sing badly.
Mm.
That's a similar concept.
I think I know what you mean. I think I know what you mean.
I've lost it there a little bit, but
it takes a lot of skill to look bad.
Deliberately make a found footage film look found footage, but at the same time have so much attention to detail and craftsmanship and just all round everything is a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Some
100%. Films are made with a $60 million budget and they look shit and they look cheap.
Yeah. But you just need to look like modern horror. There are so many found footage films now and none of them come close to it. The only one that came close, I think, was Paranormal Activity. And again, that was because it deliberately used the no-name actors. It used the shittest cameras you could find to go back to that thing of filling in the blanks. Like you're watching loads of really dark security camera footage, and you're squinting at things in the shadows in the corner of the room to try and is that someone there? And that was the only other time I think it came close. But Blair Witch was just. It speaks volumes that, what is it, 23 years later, and it's still the best, I think.
And I think the sight of someone standing in a corner has ever been so terrifying. God. I'd never get past, it was Josh, wasn't it? No, it was Mike in the end. Yeah.
Did you ever see the alternative endings?
I don't know if I did.
they released it on Blu-ray. The DVD didn't have them, but they re-released it on Blu-ray, which is the most pointless film to ever put on Blu-ray because the quality is abysmal. But the Blu-ray had different endings. And one of the endings is even scarier, but it makes no sense at all. So it does kind of kill the illusion a bit as well, because it then makes you realise that they filmed that last scene in the house a couple of times. And in one of the alternative endings, she runs down the stairs and screaming, "Josh, Josh, Josh." And when she gets out of that room, he's floating in the middle of the room. Uh-huh. In midair, kind of like the Nine Inch Nails closer video. He's kind of he's kind of jumping in the air, and he's like just floating in midair. And she's screaming, and then she gets knocked down, and it's terrifying to see, because I think it would have worked. It would have worked. I still think him standing in the corner was the best ending, because it was addressed earlier in the film.
It's a
callback, exactly. It's a perfect setup. But I think this would have worked as an ending too, because you've just watched a really shit quality, like, homemade movie right up to the end, and then suddenly you see this thing, which is just like, and you're like, how the hell do you do that with a handheld camera? That's terrifying.
That's an interesting point you should bring up with the alternate ending and the floating thing, because it's a beautiful analog for all the ghost and UFO and Bigfoot footage has always been caught on shitty shaky cams.
Yeah, exactly.
And that ending would have been a beautiful payoff, because finally you've got a found footage archive and they've actually caught this on a camera in the woods. Right, no one ever catches that. Oh look, there's a massive triangle shaped UFO, quick get the shittiest camera and someone with the shakes, just try and catch it. But
they're nervous, Chris, just, they're nervous.
That would have been amazing. Like
that these people died to bring you finally.
Yeah. But I actually really prefer that real subtle, because if you blink or you scratch your nose at that precise second, you miss the payoff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You miss the 50-50 chance. It's like, are these legends real?
Yeah.
Are they
a
thing? Is he standing in the corner?
Ugh.
Or is it just an extreme elaborate prank that goes wrong?
And it also adds like an that really cool thing that I love sometimes you get in horror movies, where you get an extra chill after the film. When somebody missed that bit, or they caught that bit earlier on and didn't put two and two together. Like that happened to one of my pals. I went to the cinema with my pal to see it, and they came out. You know, we were talking, obviously, you've seen it, you're like, was it real, was it this or that? And then in the group, there was like one guy who's like, I didn't get the ending. It was weird, it was just standing. And then you say to him, do you remember they said earlier that the kid was made to stand in the corner? And you can see, you just see the fear in his face as he realises. And it's rare that a horror movie adds a fright, like after the movie's ended, you're just talking about it.
That delayed reaction is
just sitting in Pizza Hut chewing yourself.
Yeah, and that's when you know your film has hit the right people.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah,
when it works like that, it's just. I mean, I saw it on DVD. I think at one of the many house parties I had at like high school. It's just like, and I'm one of those people that can completely dissociate from horror.
Yeah,
I enjoy them, but like Jason, I don't deliberately seek them out. But if someone says to me, "I'll watch this," is really good. I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
I like supernatural horror. I don't like slasher horror. Slasher horror bores me to fucking tears. But give me the supernatural stuff. That stuff you can't explain, that real weird, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting there and I was watching it and everyone was like all screaming and I was just sitting there. I was just like, I like the anxiety was good. But that's the whole point of it.
Yeah.
That was the whole point of it. And they're all screaming about noises and stuff. And I remember seeing the ending and being that only kid in the room full of people that was so profoundly affected in a sheer, not in a scared way, but in a sheer, oh my God, they went there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did it. And I was amazed. I was more amazement and like, I wanted to get up and like cheer and clap because I was just like, yes.
Like an American movie guy. Well, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Not quite, but you get the idea. I was just like one of those proper film nerds. I was like, they did it. They followed through with a Chekhov's gun. That's great.
But when I watched this yesterday in preparation, and I really did. I mean, I haven't seen this film since, you know, 2000, I think. So I'd kind of forgotten a lot about it, apart from the, you know, obviously the famous bits.
Yeah.
But rewatching it now, it kind of made me really appreciate the work that they did in setting up the whole story from all those interviews that they did at the beginning, talking to all these different people. And it really filled you in on the Blair Witch and the legacy and this, that, and the other. And as listeners will know, I enjoy a good atmosphere. You know, it's, if a film's created this like really cool atmosphere, it just makes me enjoy the movie so much more. Mm. And through them setting up all this like story so in such a good way, and then even like at the beginning of the film, it's quite slow, but they're showing you all these different things, like where they find the stones and they find all the, what are they, that hanging from the trees, all the stick.
Yeah, I forget what the word is now for them, but yeah, I know what you mean.
And like the feeling of like, you know, it's just these three people in this forest, and I don't know, like it all just created this atmosphere that really like did put you a little bit on edge, because when the things were happening in the nighttime, all that stuff that they'd done during the day and the setting up, it just made all that so much more eerie and just scary. And even now, like, I mean, I watched it with headphones, so like all the
perfect,
branch snappings and the kids and all this and that, it still gave me goosebumps even now.
I think sometimes like we're filling in the blanks. I think a lot of the fear comes actually, I find, from when they are just roaming around in the daytime, because you're thinking, what's out there? Where is it? Mm-hmm. Where is it when it is daytime? It obviously has to be somewhere. It doesn't just, you know, magically appear at night. So it's that kind of idea of, again, you're filling in the blanks. You're thinking, you know, how big are these woods? Where is this witch? And yeah, and then you're just waiting for night to fall. And that is just...
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. It's that kind of emotional roller coaster where it deliberately does all the weird stuff at night. Mm-hmm. So then when daytime hits, you're almost sitting going, oh, good. Like, yes. I can rest for a minute. It's the same. Paranormal Activity did the same, where you can, or during the daytime scenes, you go, right, I know for a fact nothing is going to happen during the day. And there's drama with dropping the map in the water and all that kind of stuff. And you go, but then as night falls, you instantly become terrified even before anything's happened.
Yeah, because it's the instinctive night and day, isn't it? Like,
yeah, that's what I was doing. I was like, I could see it was getting dusky, and I was like, oh shit, it's getting, you know, it's getting nighttime again. Fucking come on, guys, get moving. Stop hanging around and arguing. Whatever else you're doing, just fucking get on with it.
Yeah,
and, get in the tent. If I remember, I mean, I haven't seen it in a few years, but I know it really well, but don't they amp it up like gradually, like as it starts to just get to twilight and they hear stuff?
Yeah.
And then does it get louder and more intense as the night goes on? I can't remember if that's a thing or not. Maybe my brain's just making shit up. I don't know.
I mean, like I said, I watched it yesterday, and majority of the stuff was happening when it was pitch black.
So proper nightfall.
Mm.
And then there's the whole thing as well. Obviously, I know the theories kind of came about later with like Book of Shadows, which I only watched for the first time last year.
Don't get me started on Book of Shadows.
It's year 2000, the movie. Yeah, I love it. But Disposable Teens at the start, I was like, I'm having the time of my life.
Adore that film. And I do. For all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, it's like repackaged Final Destination, isn't it? It's like,
it's awful, but I love it.
And it wasn't done found footage, it was done straight lay, set camera, like full widescreen. I was like, you're missing the point of the original film.
Even with Book of Shadows, I know they kind of really went heavy handed with it, with that, I personally think, awful reboot. Well, Adam Wingard one.
I never seen it.
Yeah, I didn't either.
But they kind of touch more upon the whole supernatural element, not just a witch, but whole time and space and manipulation of where they are. And going back and watching the very original Blair Witch again, you do start to wonder how much that is at play, because they keep finding they're getting more and more lost. They're covering the same ground again when they thought they were getting nearer to the car. And I don't know how much of it is actually was the filmmaker's intention, or if you are kind of viewing it through that lens of what was part of the conversation after the fact, that if it was, you know, more timey-wimey and, you know, wibbly-wobbly and that kind of stuff.
Oh, God.
I mean, it was cool because at the time they brought out a book, like, to accompany it, like a kind of... one of these kind of... what was it called? The Blair Witch Project, a dossier. And it was like a... pretended it carried on the kind of idea there was a true story. So you get like loads of police reports in it and newspaper articles and stuff about the history of Ellie Kedward and Rustin Parr and all the kind of old legends and stuff. And it included like more of these kind of weird like the time shift and stuff. So that book reveals that they found the tapes in the ruins of a house. But the tapes were underneath these bricks that hadn't been moved for years. It's like, well, how were they buried there? Because it looked like where they were buried hadn't been disturbed for a long time, and weird shit like that. So the book gives you like a wee chill going, ooh.
I didn't know that existed. That sounds like a real proper like X-Files tie-in.
It's a fantastic, it's a proper, it's basically like a lore book. Like it's like if you came away from the movie going, ooh, this book was like perfectly... it came out like I think like 2 months after the film or something, because it was like part of the, and they just kind of jammed in all the kind of weird shit. It's fantastic. It's worth watching the movie and then reading that book right after it, just to kind of it's a fun book.
Well, the director's kept in touch with actors Heather Donahue, Michael C. Williams, and Joshua Leonard via walkie-talkies to ensure the three would not become lost during their trek. Reportedly, they did get lost at least 3 times. And around 46 minutes in, a scene where the main characters are sleeping in a tent at night, the tent suddenly shakes violently and they all get scared. This was unscripted and the director shook the tent. The actors actually were scared, which kind of leads back to what you were saying earlier, Chris.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I love that.
That's like making Drew Barrymore cry at the end of E.T. It's like proper method traumatising, isn't it? Like
The Blair Witch was released on the 22nd of October 1999 with a budget of $60,000. You want to take a stab at how much it actually took worldwide?
Didn't it do about 250 mil, I think?
But you're pretty much spot on there, mate. Yep, $248 million.
Ridiculous. So just about broke even after marketing then. Okay. Didn't you have to make that 3 times the budget to break even, I heard, after marketing costs? I think they just got past the finish line.
We're talking about the method acting. Did you ever hear the story about the exorcist at the end when the priest's given the other priest his last rites? Did you ever hear that story?
I remember heard something, but I don't remember the specifics. So
basically, the director, like Friedkin, the director, was a maniac. And
yes,
there's like a bit where like the priest Father Karras falls out, that jumps out the window and falls down the stairs, and he's lying dead. His friend, who's like another priest, has to come and give him like give him his last rites and like bless him and stuff as he's dying. And he did it over and over and over again. It's freezing, and the director's like, "You're not doing it right. You're not showing enough emotion." And this guy's just like a normal priest. He wasn't actually an actor. And he's like, "Mate, I'm doing my best here." And he walked over to him and he says, "Come here." And he absolutely slapped him right across the face, like in full force across the face, and said, "Do it." And they started filming it, and you could see his hands shaking while he's trying to bless him, and it's like legitimate reaction to him having been slapped in the face. And it was like, that's the shot that's in the film, is the emotion to him crying over his dead friend is just him like just messed up. It's incredible.
Okay, so it's like proper pure adrenaline running through him.
Exactly. Apparently, he used to just like fire guns during filming and stuff, just to kind of mess people's heads up. It's
10 points for creativity. I mean,
human resources wouldn't have any of that these days.
Not the chance.
No, not with Alec Baldwin.
I was waiting.
There we go.
That was quick, considering the week I've had. That's just like that.
Awesome pick there, Chris. Let's jump into your second film.
Okay, my second film, I believe, is on Disney Plus, the home of horror. And yeah, I'm curious to see what the feedback is this one, because it's Alien 3.
Here, in a world where the sun burns cold, and the wind blows colder, a visitor has come, but not by herself.
It started.
Come on! The suspense is back.
and we have no weapons of any kind?
The fear is back.
No! Don't look back, dude! Run as fast as you can!
And most of all, the bitch is back. Alien 3.
Mainly because Alien and Aliens were in the 90s.
Yeah,
give it up.
And Alien Resurrection just doesn't bear talking about. So it had to be Alien 3. I've got a soft spot for Alien 3, even though so much was wrong about it. I love the twist of putting Ripley on a planet where there's no weapons. I love just how bad the CGI is. There's like no good CGI. I love the subsequent video games that came out that totally just ditched the entire thing and gave her like every weapon going. Something about it, and I've seen like Fincher's cut. You know, they brought it out on the Blu-rays and DVDs, and they let you see David Fincher's like separate cut. And I don't know. I just prefer. I think it's because it's the one I grew up with. I prefer the original, and despite all its flaws, and that kind of iconic. You got those two iconic scenes. When you think of Alien 3, you instantly picture that shot of Sigourney Weaver with the alien's face right up to her face. Yeah. And then you if you've seen it, you picture the ending when she jumps. And that's two kind of iconic moments in the history of the series. So Alien and Aliens will always obviously be better. But I think when you consider all the stuff that came after it, like Resurrection and Alien vs. Predator and Alien vs. Predator 2 and all the other nonsense, I think Alien 3 counts as the third best Alien movie, in my humble opinion. And this is where I now get torn apart.
No, I mean, you can see like it was the ending of Ripley's story and they should have just left it there, really. Like you say, I mean, the film does have its issues and its problems, and surprising, like you say, with the CGI, considering it was just the same year that Terminator 2 came out, and look at the CGI they managed to do in that. But through all the faults, I mean, it did give Ripley an ending, and I think
I'm disappointed that it gave Newt an ending as well. That was a kind of sore point. But
Rich, what's your thoughts on Alien 3?
I mean, of all the Alien films, obviously of the trilogy, this is one I've watched the least, but what I always kind of liked about it, it does have more sort of connective tissue, I think, with the original than even Aliens does. Even though Aliens is probably my favourite, I like the fact this one is light on guns. You've got, literally, it's got more that chill, that kind of claustrophobic feeling. The fact that everyone on the planet, it's instead of bullets, they've got like a truss system, so it's... That's what's kind of, it always kind of has those vibes of like The Thing in a way. Like, that's why I kind of look at it, that's why I kind of compare it. And probably the thing it has mostly in common with the original is that it's full of like, you know, British thespians. You've got John Hurt and Ian Holm, but in this you've got the best of, you know, British stage and screen. But they've all got shaved heads and I can't tell them apart. So, But yeah, this one was a hard one for me. I found it, obviously, to me, it was quite slow. I think I really just enjoyed Aliens that much that I never really got on with this one. I don't view it as bad. I know some people do like to kind of dunk on it a bit. It is definitely better than Resurrection, and it's leagues better than what came after that. I know that Ridley Scott was at one point being courted for this, and I kind of wish he did do it, because he maybe would have got Alien out of his system and never made Prometheus and Covenant.
Everything else.
Prometheus is fine. Covenant is just a dumpster fire. So I wish he made this. But I've never had a great deal to say about Alien 3, even watching it again. To me, it's kind of like, I don't feel passionately against it, and I think I enjoyed it more than I did the very last time I watched it. So... I don't know.
The fact it came after Aliens was one of the biggest things going against it, I think, because when you have Alien as the kind of the tense one, and then you have Aliens as the all out action one, to then have Alien 3 attempt to dial back and lose the action again, you're literally putting on a kind of space, a prison ship with zero weapons on it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you're like, okay, so how are we doing this? Is this action or is it not action? It felt like it couldn't really decide what it wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like dog aliens for no reason.
Yeah.
It really kind of disturbing autopsy scene on Newt mm-hmm. as well. And you're just like, So yeah, but for some reason, it always kind of stuck with me. It was just, I should probably point out that if there were more 90s horror movies on streaming services, then we may have been talking about something else. But there's surprisingly few. But yeah, it just purely as a curio, I think Alien 3 is an interesting watch.
No, I totally do understand that vibe, and I do totally respect that.
Yes. One of those cases, I think they just tried to recapture the lightning in a bottle that was the first one.
Yeah.
Building on that anxiety and that locked-in feeling like you're in a ship in space. You can't mm-hmm. just fucking open the door and run away as fast and far as you can.
Yeah.
You're stuck. Whereas, like, you guys literally just said, like, the first one was the slow-burning, anxiety-ridden horror. Aliens was the shoot-em-up sequel. And Alien 3 came along, and it was kind of like this weird amalgamation of both of them. And it did. I don't think David Fincher knew what it wanted to be, and I think he's gone on record as saying that he hated it.
Yeah, he despises it.
That
yeah.
he wanted his name struck off the credit before release, and the studio said no. Like, you can see that they're trying hard, but I think it's a perfect case study of what James Cameron can do on a very low, limited, next to nothing budget, and then what another director can attempt to do on a similar low budget are two completely different products.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did it have such a small budget, do you think? Like, after the success of Aliens, do you think 20th Century Fox would be throwing everything at it?
Look, like Chris said and Rich said, look at the CG, and I believe there's a blend of go motion in there as well, or stop motion.
Yeah.
Of the two, and obviously actors in suits. But when I was watching it, I was struck by how dated the miniature effects were. And how dated the CG and physical blending was. But then when you watch the original and Aliens, you realise, hang on a minute, it looks so much better 5 or 10 years before. And it's weird to kind of work out how and why. I don't know why. Maybe it's just me overthinking it, but...
Well, it didn't help that the filming and just the general development of the film was just an absolute mess from start to finish.
They didn't even have a script, I believe, did they?
Yeah, there was like 7 different scripts. They were pushing it from as soon as Aliens was finished, they were pushing to get it made. And it went through like 7 or some totally different scripts. And then, yeah, by the time they started filming it, they'd already spent millions on it. And it still didn't have a script. And just like they're just shooting like just scenes that just like totally they just didn't join together. So yeah, it was a mess from the start, and it's actually amazing that a film came out of it. when you watch the documentaries that came with it's weird because the documentaries that came with the DVDs and later the Blu-rays, like, you can tell because Fox released them, they were kind of holding back a bit. They weren't kind of giving the full story, but even with those kind of Fox controlled documentaries, you could still tell the tension and that this was a shit show basically from start to finish. So I'm just like, in a sense, I think that's another reason why I like it, is that a film actually emerged from it.
Yeah. When I was watching it earlier, I was amazed at the scale of the sets. Now, I don't know how much was filmed on location or was built over here in the studios.
Yeah,
but it looks stunning, and it feels. Yeah. We've all been to old buildings and museums and old factory buildings when we were kids and dragged to school trips. Mm-hmm. It reminds you of that, and it's so relatable because it looks like what we all grew up going to see: old castles, old factories. You know, it just feels so human.
Yeah,
and again, to place it in a place with no guns, and like Rich said, they're using a trust thing, and who can manipulate who, and who can manipulate. It's using it back to basics, but the sets just, they were lit lovely and they look stunning. But was anyone else taken out of the film? Right, it's full of British actors, like we just said.
Yeah.
You got an amazing turn from Paul McGann and Pete Postlethwaite in there. But Ralph Brown? Was everyone just having Wayne's World flashbacks about Ozzy's story? Was it just me?
No, yeah, I'm with you.
He's one of those actors that you can't unhear his voice. And as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh my God. It's like, no. I just had to throw it in there. It made me laugh today because I completely forgot he was in it until I heard him speak.
Same.
And I was just like, huh? And then I just got distracted because I was just replaying that Wayne's World scene. But other than that, it was enjoyable. But yeah. I think Sigourney Weaver carried a 2-hour film almost single-handedly because a lot of the actors in there, including Charles Dance, they're not really in it that much.
Mm. Yeah, she's one of the only kind of things left that carried over from the previous films, because we think that she's there. The Stan Winston didn't make Stan Winston obviously did the effects in Aliens, but he didn't come back for this. Because David Fincher went to H.R. Giger and said, "I want you to redesign the Alien," and he came up with all these kind of really weird new designs for the Alien, and like pretty much none of them were used. Like kind of Dogbuster was the only one that was designed by Giger. All the other stuff wasn't his either. So Ripley, like Sigourney Weaver, was the kind of main, other than the aliens themselves, the thing that brought over from the previous series. So she basically had to carry it. Like when you kill Hicks instantly and you kill Newt instantly and basically completely wipe the second movie out of existence and just say, right, start again. Like, it's fair play there.
Can I just say though, as when I watched this when I was younger, probably in the mid-90s, I believe, I was convinced. I remembered the scene with Bishop, and I remember it being Lance Henriksen. But when I watched it today, I was like, "Shit, that's a puppet." Can I just say how amazing that puppet work was in this film? I don't know who's responsible for it, but that whole scene with Bishop is all puppet work, including the eyes, the skin, the lips, the teeth. It's beautiful. It looks stunning. I was blown away by it. I had memories of it as a kid going like, oh, it's, you know, going to be Lance Henriksen. I was like, no, Jesus Christ. I don't know who did the effects work.
Yeah, some of the practical effects were incredible in that film. Like the, I don't know if it's that one that had like, there was like a dead Ripley or something as well. Maybe that might have been a later one. Yeah, some of the special effects were like incredible. Like for that, especially when you look at how bad the CG was. It showed like the 90s is that kind of era where practical effects died out.
We're on that cusp of that turning point, aren't we?
That's why it's one of the reasons I love the 90s movies. So the 80s will always be like my thing because that was when I kind of started to grow up. But the 90s was my entire childhood. And I love that kind of, that really weird experimental like stage where some studios were just clinging to the practical effects and like, no, we need to have big rubber monsters and lots of goop and all this kind of stuff. Whereas others were saying, no, let's, the CGI is the future, let's do this. It's just the awful, like, initial, like, Terminator 2 aside, obviously, the kind of awful first attempts at adding CG to movies. It's an exciting, when you watch them nowadays, it's like they're laughably bad, but it's also charming to see the kind of early stages of what would become kind of the movies that we watch today.
And like what you're saying about that puppet work, with that scene, the famous scene where the aliens right up close to Ripley, and they bring out the little mouth, whatever it is, that's inside the mouth.
Yeah, and I had all the saliva dripping down the teeth and everything. Yeah. And
it kind of just shudders. I've always loved that effect. So.
Yeah,
but by shuddering, it gives you that sense of realism because everyone's constantly moving. Nothing's static.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I love how we bring up Stan Winston and Phil Tippett, who did a lot of the go motion stuff in the 80s and early 90s. By giving the micro movements, it adds realism. And that comes from Ray Harryhausen, because if you watch that famous scene in Jason the Argonauts, the skeletons aren't all just moving and reacting to swords. Each one has its tiny little human character traits. And I watched a breakdown of that effect, weirdly, about 2 or 3 months ago. And one skeleton that walks past a wall towards to flank the guy on one side. He walks past the wall and he stops, and this tiny little idiosyncratic movement, he looks around the wall, steps back a half a step, and then rejudges and then moves on. You only see it properly in slow motion. Yeah, but when you watch it, full speed, you don't pick up on it because your brain tells you that's natural.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Subconsciously you believe
and
it.
Ray Harryhausen was putting that shit in his movies way back then.
Yeah.
And now we've got incredible people like Phil Tippett and doing that with his Go Motion, like constantly keeping those puppets moving rather than just static stop motion. It's just, That's where the shudders come in, and it just works really well. Like, even when we always bring up Jurassic Park, watch those physical dinosaurs, they all move.
Yeah.
Because they're puppets and they're heavy and they're standing on these frames, they're going to wobble a bit, but that adds so much more nuance to them because they are wobbling.
Yeah.
Your brain's 100%. Going, like, wow.
But that whole scene, like, when the alien gets up close to Ripley, the alien doesn't attack her, and, of course, we learn later in the film that she's pregnant with a queen. Do we think it really needed that in the film, or was it a good addition to the story?
I think it was needed in that... I don't know, needed. There was other ways they could have done it, but I think to end Ripley's story... You needed a good kind of reason for that story to what appeared to be definitively end until resurrection came along. But considering her whole arc from the first alien up to now was that the first alien, she discovers this creature, the second alien, she becomes the expert on it, and by the third one, basically her mission in life is to exterminate it. So, like, the pretty much putting a queen in her and her realizing that she could be the person responsible for continuing this species, and that her fate is ultimately to what she thinks is stop it from existing. I think it was a satisfying end of her kind of arc, but I'm sure there's other ways they could have done it without her getting up the duff.
I'm glad they didn't film that.
That's one deleted that sex scene that we're never going to see.
The film faced problems during production, as we've touched upon, including shooting without a script, and various screenwriters and directors were attached to the film. Fincher, in his feature directorial debut, was brought in to direct after a proposed version with Vincent Ward as director was cancelled during pre-production. I mean, I feel like this is one of those films that is probably more interesting to watch about how it was made than the actual film in itself. Michael Bain stated in an interview that he was deeply hurt that he wasn't asked to return as Corporal Dwayne Hicks, his character from Aliens, but even more so that the film opened with Hicks immediately being killed off after escaping with the other survivors. He stated that he didn't mind Hicks dying per se, but objected to the carelessness way that they did it in the film. He therefore refused the studio permission to use a dummy of a corpse in his likeness, but allowed them the use of his photograph. Carrie Henn, on the other hand, was more accepting of her character Newt's death, simply stating, "Life goes on."
Unless you knew.
Yeah. Released on the 21st of August 1992 with a budget of $50 million, it took worldwide
$159.
So, okay. Not bad. Excellent. Well, one more film to...
There's just a little observation, sorry, that's just literally flagged up in my brain, right? I'm not going to be one of these people who's a technology spotter. I'm not one of those people, but I've just had this memory. These alien films, they take place, what, roughly 2170 or 2190, don't they?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So when the Wayland group turn up with the doctors and the cleanup crew and the scientists and the guy who invents the android, Bishop, did anyone clock that humongous super 1980s video camera that dude was holding?
I didn't.
I wouldn't have noticed it if it wasn't such a big scene, because the guy shouting, like, no pictures, no film, don't turn it off. And I looked at the screen and I was like, what the fuck? Seriously, it's like this humongous old school video camera. How difficult would it be for them to whip up, with the spare parts bin at the special props guys, some futuristic looking thing with a couple of flashing LEDs on it?
That's the thing, because by that point, you'd think they would have been wise to it, because obviously the first Alien, the computer and all that was like massively basic, and it's almost kind of really cool kind of retro look now. The computer stuff on the ship in the original Alien looks like laughably prehistoric for something that's set in the future. But by the time Alien 3 came out, computers, you had Windows and stuff like that, and so people must have known by that point. You know something, if we put technology in this film, it's going to look out of date in a few years' time, because that's what happened with the first one. So at that point, they must have thought, will video cameras still be this size, 100 and whatever years from now? Or do you think maybe they might get a tiny wee bit smaller?
We had camcorders then that weren't that big. This thing's the size of, a massive camera from the 1980s. It's like the JVC that Marty McFly has in Back to the Future. It's jarringly massive.
Almost like they were like, guys, we need a camera and we've got nothing. Ah, shit, just take this movie wand that we used to film the film with.
We've got a backup hand cam here, never use.
Yeah. It's got some tinfoil on it, so it looks realistic.
But it didn't even do that. You can see the cassette deck in it. It was mad. I had to laugh. I literally laughed at it today. I was like, what? No.
Awesome. Good spotting, mate. Good spotting. I didn't notice that at all. Let's move on to Chris's last pick of his horror films of the 90s. And what did you choose, Chris?
Well, for this one, it's a wee bit cheaty because it came out in the 90s, but I think most people in the West didn't kind of discover it until the early 2000s. But the film is, people call it Ring, but I suppose the original title was Ringu. Kind of Japanese version.
Christ's sake.
Sorry.
Oh, I only just got that.
I'm glad you got it. I've been weird.
That's really scary, that bit in the film where the penguin pisses himself.
I was going to say, I'm not the only one whose first image was Pingu pissing himself in the igloo.
Once you see that instantly becomes Pingu's calling card. Is his poor bladder. So anyway,
sorry, Chris. Continue.
Obviously, this series became more popular in the West when The Ring came out, the kind of American remake. But before that, there was this kind of Japanese film, and it's so, at the time when I first saw it, it was unlike anything else I'd seen, because it Japanese horror, J horror, if you will, was kind of an unknown entity in the West, and Ring was kind of so popular that it kind of brought over a lot of other kind of Asian horror in its wake, and it's the perfect for me. It's a Marmite film. I'm sure a lot of people watch it and go, this is boring me shitless, but I think for people who it clicks with, it's got this kind of unrelentingly slow pace, and it's just this really eerie build, slowly. When she watches the tape, the start of the cursed videotape, and it's just the most bizarre, creepy looking thing, and with weird sound effects, and then just as it goes on, just really unsettling stuff, like a flashback of someone dead in a closet with a terrified face, and then the bit where she finds photographs and everyone's face is blurred in them, and then the kind of ending is one of the most kind of iconic endings in horror, I think, especially if you never kind of saw it coming. So it's similar to Blair Witch. After kind of my Blair Witch fandom died down and I went to uni and discovered Ring, that became my next obsession, and I've kind of, when the remake came out, I dragged 10 friends from uni to go and see the remake, and they couldn't give a shit. It's like, come on, it's the ring. So yeah, I like the remake as well, but I mean, that's for another decades podcast. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really started, I got really obsessed with Ringu for a while, and it's kind of weird sequels, and I really got into the lore of that, and the kind of the fact that these kind of the ghost in it, the kind of, which everyone knows, the iconic kind of girl in the white dress with the long dark hair, is actually kind of a long running Japanese thing. It's been going since like the year 700. This is like a well-known Japanese ghost, but for people in the West, it was just like, well, this is you, this is fucking terrifying. So yeah, it's one of those films that will always kind of stick with me, and like, even like more than 20 years later, just like, I still remember the feeling when I first saw that ending, and it's just like chilling.
I've never seen this version, like I said at the beginning, like, I don't seek out horror films really, but so I don't really have a lot of memory of actually watching the remake. I mean, I knew of the story and what its basic premise was, but yeah. I mean, as I've got older, I'm more open to watching different kinds of horror films. So I don't know if I was just being a scaredy cat back when I was in the teenagers. I don't know, but so, and I've never seen this version of The Ring, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, like you say, I thought it was really good in the slow build up and the way they introduced you to everything with the video itself, and where the story goes, and they find the well under the house, and you start like really panicking with the characters as the woman's running out of time, and they're trying to get all this water out the well to find this body, and then they think, you know, they think they've got it, and they, you know, that they haven't. Yeah, I just really loved everything about this, and the story, and that ending was spectacular.
Yeah, it's just one of those ones when you, it's one of those movies where if someone's seen it and you say Ring, they instantly picture that, her standing at the TV.
Mm.
It's just, yeah, and it's like, I remember I watched it with my brother. My brother's like a massive horror movie fan as well. Me and him like just watched horror all the time, and I'd seen it first at uni, and not a lot of stuff scares him. Like, he's like, he was into horror before I was even, and he's younger than me, but he was like, he was always the tough one. And so he loved like all horror. And I'd seen this and I said, Kev, you need to watch this. So I brought it home and we started watching it. And about 30 minutes in, after they watched the tape and you see the kind of girl scared and the dead girl in the cupboard and stuff, he turned to me and was like, Chris, is this the sort of film that could fuck a man up? I was like, maybe. He's like, let's just put it off. So put it off. We didn't watch the rest of it. That was the end of it. And like, yeah, it's weird how it affects people. But like, one of my flatmates wasn't really a film buff and wasn't really into horror or anything like that. And he was one of the ones that I dragged to see the American remake, and was kind of nonchalant, a load of shit and all this kind of stuff. But I went in his room one night to borrow something and noticed that his TV had been turned around to face the wall. I didn't say anything, but I was just like, yeah, he's got it. But, I love it.
What, the perfect child in this film? Can we just bottle this child up and give it to everybody? I mean, and he'd just go to school. I mean, he prepped dinner to the mum, and you know, they were quite happy leaving him at home alone quite a lot. Yeah. And I thought he was only about 5 or 6. I mean, he was amazing. He was probably one of the best characters in the film.
Yeah, yeah, I never liked the kid in the remake. I found him way too just eerie and almost a bit of a smart ass. But
yeah, my daughter's 3, so she's nearly at that point now where she can basically take care of me, according to the ring. Wow. According to ring rules.
A couple of years, then I'm typical Japan, though, isn't it? They're all self-sufficient by like the age of 10. Like, prime example, I went to college with a girl called Airy. She's Korean and lovely. We're still good friends now, the group of us. And we're at college and we're doing things that we thought were complex. She comes in and she starts doing these like really like elaborate cake decorations and like... amazing, like, I went to chef college, basically, guys, and we're like, where are you getting all these advanced techniques? We're in like year 2 and she's doing stuff that you do like in a restaurant. She got taught that at school.
That's crazy.
Wow.
And when I say school, I don't mean high school, I mean like at the age of 9 or 10, they were taught to be self-sufficient, provide for your family, cook really good food and make it look really nice.
Yeah, I mean, this is not, you know, obviously a school podcast or anything, but I mean, like personally, I mean, that's what they need to be doing in this country. So.
No, but that was my weird segue about that, was just from experience, I can see that that's a real thing, that those kids are, at a young age, can be trusted and will do that stuff, and they wouldn't screw around. It's not a weird culture. I mean, it's a weird to us because we're not used to that culture, but from me experiencing the Korean culture, where she's told us that they're taught at a young age how to fix clothes and how to basically provide for a family. So when they do come of age after high school or whatever, they're ready.
Yeah.
It was nuts. It was crazy. Never seen anything like it in my life, and still haven't.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Rich, what's your feelings on Ring U?
Ping-U? Yeah. I was all about Ringu and Ring. I did actually watch this for the first time as the remake. Then I probably the same year went back and watched the Japanese one. And it is better. There are certain things I think that the remake did better, but yeah, I won't get into that conversation too much. I think what worked so well for me at the time, less so now because I think we're more exposed to the culture, but what was so powerful about Japanese horror was that I think with Asian cinema in general, the setting was quite alien, and I think that in itself, not in a horrible way, but it was almost unsettling in that it was a total reset. Like, social norms, the actual environments you were seeing on screen weren't familiar, so it almost kind of, you didn't know where the rules were. It did things that you didn't see in conventional, you know, Western horror, and yeah, it just kind of reset the rule book. What I think is so good about Japanese horror is because it does tap so much into like folklore, a lot of it deals with really intense like themes such as like regret and sadness, abandonment, and those things never actually really ever go away in your life. So they're quite relatable. And I think because the horror is based in reality, the horror almost kind of always wins. And that in itself is really unsettling. And I think that's what really freaked people out with the remake, because we never really had that style of, you know, storytelling in a horror film before. Mm-hmm. It was just so uniquely different. And yeah, I think just something as basic as taking something like a television set and making you just absolutely terrified, as proven with Chris's friend, that stays with you. That absolutely stays with you. And that final act when... Oh, it was Sadako, wasn't it, in the Japanese version? I want to say Samara, but I won't say that. It's just terrifying. I mean, even when I saw the posters for the first time, seeing that well, and you knowing that some hands are going to come out of that, girl's going to climb out and slowly make her way towards the screen, I'm just like, no. It's like, none of that. And yeah, that final shot, that final scene is amazing when she comes out, and the close shot of the eye when she's staring down is just horrifying. Something I never liked about the remake, because they really overproduced the shit out of that scene when it was like she's almost being beamed into the apartment, and she's all glitchy and digital, and there's water pouring out, and I was like, you've done too much. Keep it simple, rein it in. And yeah,
it is a really interesting case study if you take both those endings and put them side by side, because even when I dragged everyone to the cinema to watch the American one, I was like really curious. I loved the remake. It's one of the few remakes I like. or at the time, I can appreciate remakes now, but at the time I was a really snobby horror fan. I was like, Dawn of the Dead was the only one I accepted. No, the other ones could like piss off. But the ending, even knowing that the ending was coming, I was still kind of fascinated by how they handled it, because like you say, that it went in. Although it's the same ending, technically, it does go in a very different direction. And if you put them both side by side, the Japanese one is just so quiet. Like, you hear the kind of just the background, like the noise of the TV, and she kind of slowly walks towards it, and he's just sitting there like stunned. Whereas the American one, she starts moving towards the TV, and then it cuts to Naomi Watts in a car chase, basically driving to the flat, and she nearly crashes. And you're quickly kind of thrown off, and you're going, oh, and you gather your thoughts, and you're thinking, she's walking towards the TV, what's going on here? In the Japanese one, you don't really get a chance to kind of gather your thoughts because she just keeps walking. You're like, the American one, you're like, oh, she's coming. And you kind of gather your thoughts about it. It's a bit weird. And then she finally comes out the TV. And because it's America, they can't resist putting like a jump scare in there. Mm. So she crawls out the TV and then instantly appears right in front of him. As like a final jump scare. And you're like, well, that's America for you then.
It's almost if the American version was edited deliberately to break that up, to break that anxiety up.
Yeah, exactly. Because it may have been too much.
Yeah, because...
like, what's the fun in that?
I know, exactly. But you... when you're watching the original, you're focusing on her just as much as he is.
Yeah.
You are put in the position that he is. You are essentially him watching this happen. You watch the US version, and then, like you said, all of a sudden you've got that jump cut to a car chase, and it's almost as if they're breaking that tension up.
Yeah, just to give you a
breath. To give you a breather, and then you're back into it again with the cheap jump scare.
I mean, it's also weird. It's one of these series, one of these franchises where a lot of the other stuff is a bit shit. So like they had like sequels that and I don't know if it's just like being lost in translation, but like it had a sequel on the same day. It was released on the same day, called Raisin or Razin, like it translates to the spiral, and it's just so confusing. I've tried to watch that like 3 or 4 times and just have no idea what's going on. And then Ring 2 came out and it was really confusing, and there was like Ring 0 and I didn't know what was going on there. The American Ring 2 and then the one they brought after that, I didn't like those too much. It really just happens to be the first Japanese one and the first American one. I even saw there was a Korean remake called The Ring Virus, and that was pretty awful. Like it was pretty accurate, but then when she comes out the TV, or when it shows your face, it's like, you know, some people can turn their eyelid inside out. It just basically did that, and I was like, oh, that's a bit of shit. But yeah, it's just something about that first one and the American remake just kind of absolutely nailed it. There's also like a Dreamcast game, which is one of the
worst games. Terror's Realm, good game, not bad. God. Well, terrible.
I love it for being awful. It's the Blair Witch Book of Shadows of the Ring franchise, I think.
Yeah. Have you got around to watching, Sadako versus Kayako yet? Like, The Grudge versus The Ring?
No, I definitely. It's on the watch list because I loved The Grudge as well.
Yeah, just Freddy versus Jason, which I disrespect. So,
very much.
Yeah.
My introduction to Japanese horror literally comes from Rich because.
My pleasure.
This was must have been 2000, 2001. We're in sixth form at the time. And obviously, The American Ring was out, wasn't it, about that time?
It was 2002, I think, it came out, yeah. God, 20 years this year, jeez.
Yeah, so we would have still been at sixth form at that point. And just I remember about. You used to get hold of, like, these Japanese... You used to go to HMV, or you used to get them online, didn't you? Like, Japanese versions. And it was like, oh, you know, come around and watch the Japanese version of that. And round your house, I saw the Japanese version of The Ring and the original Grudge at your place.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have access to that shit.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have...
That was back in the day when Tartan Video were the kings.
Oh, Tartan Video.
Japanese. And in hindsight, you look back and they did an awful job. But back then it was all you had. Like the subtitles were burned into it. The video quality wasn't very good.
Yeah, it was great.
And nowadays...
I remember the day you picked up, I think it was The Grudge, Rich. We went into HMV and you literally went straight to the foreign import section for the copy of this. And it seems so nostalgic now, but I'd never heard of The Ring. I wasn't up on that. So when I heard about, obviously, the Japanese version, that were around yours and you put it on, and I was just like, this is phenomenal. Like, And then I watched the remake when it came out on DVD. No, I didn't see it in the cinema. It must have been on some movie channel somewhere about 3 or 4 years later. I remember sitting there going, just like you guys have said, it's all right. It's kind of a beat-for-beat kind of remake, but there's just something missing that the original captured, even watching it subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't have that special spark that the original had. And like you said, I think it's more based in the folklore that it really embraces and runs with it.
I think the thing the American one did that kind of fell a wee bit flat for me, much as I like the American one, but given Samara, as she was known in America, a voice... and basically letting her explain what's going on. I think a lot of what's scary about the Japanese one is that a lot of it is so unexplained. And you get, you obviously get find out later on what happened to her and why she's kind of seeking revenge. But to have the girl herself, I believe is Donnie Darko's sister, like just literally like explaining in detail, this is why I'm doing this. Well, and you're like, okay, well you're removing. But again, it's the Americanizing it. They've got to spell all these things out for people. And
yeah,
add that kind of weird subplot with Brian Cox for no real reason. But yeah, so I still really like the American one, but in a different way. It's a great American a good American horror movie, but I still think the Japanese one reigns supreme, I think.
Yeah.
No, I'm agreed. I'm really happy that I've actually sat down and watched it. And I think when I was younger, I did dismiss foreign films to a certain extent because, and I think a lot of people probably have the same reason with, like, they couldn't concentrate fully on the film because they had to read the subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the things that always put me off to not watch a foreign film when I was younger. And watching this film, I watched the original Japanese dub with the subtitles, and it didn't bother me at all this time around. And I think maybe there's techniques, isn't there, to kind of reading the subtitles and watching it and kind of just got into a rhythm with it. And I was just really happy that I've sat down and watched this now. So, I mean, I think, Chris, you can have the credit of introducing me to Japanese horror. So.
I think it helps with Ring because it is quite
slow.
Yeah, it's slow and it's quite a quiet film in a way as well. I think it just helps you focus and concentrate. And I think that in itself makes it more scary because you're being more drawn in. You're not distracted. You're not just listening to dialogue while playing with your phone in the other hand, which is what you probably do all the time. I think foreign films can actually help kind of actually focus your mind and actually pay attention. And that can make it scarier.
Even Squid Game, when we watched Squid Game, and and I enjoyed it, and I didn't find the subtitles that much of an issue. So maybe I've just matured over the years.
I prefer foreign films with subtitles because you lose the genuine performance and emotional impact that the actors are putting across.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Funnily enough, I had that playing Shenmue. where I had the American dub on, and it just didn't fit.
No. It's just people phoning it in. It's just
I flicked it back to the original Japanese, and it just felt much more comfortable.
It's kind of like fully immersive, like you're playing that game with that native language.
Yeah,
and it's got so much. Yeah, it's got so much energy behind the language as well. Like all Asian languages are just so fast. That it kind of gives you that natural euphoric buzz. It's like it hypes you up because it's just so fast and energetic and not loud. But you lose that with dubbing. Like we said, I've watched many foreign films. I'll always choose subtitles over dubs.
Yeah,
and even what this Ring today. I watched it this afternoon actually
for the first time.
Jeez, Chris.
Yeah. I did. And I haven't seen it probably in 21 years. Yeah. But weirdly, when I was watching it, everything came back. And I was just like, oh, yeah, it's all familiar. It was really enjoyable. I actually really enjoyed revisiting it, to be honest.
The close-up of Sadako's eye near the end of the film was performed by a male crew member, Nohiko Miyazi. I don't know why I've done this to myself. I really don't know. By some dude, there was a crew member. There you go.
Give him a Western name. Bob Johnson. Yeah, whatever he had. There you go.
Bobson.
Mike had to chop off his eyelashes to make the shot more disturbing.
What? Fair play.
The novel was originally science fiction based, while also blending in elements of supernatural horror as well. Hideo Nakata opted to remove the science fiction elements in favour of a more traditional ghost story. The sequel, Raisin, is more faithful to the source material, keeping the science fiction portions of the story. This was released in Japan on the 31st of January 1998 with a budget of $1.2 million. When trying to research its box office, I don't think the full information is out there on what it actually managed to take. I checked on a couple of websites and they could only report back United Kingdom and, funny enough, Chile.
Okay.
Okay.
So that made a grand total of $59,000.
Yeah, because I would imagine that it, certainly in the UK, it didn't get a proper cinematic release. It would have gone straight to Tartan DVDs.
I couldn't really get any like Japanese information on you know what it took in that country and anywhere else it might have got released. So bit of a funny recording there, but that's what I could find.
Can I just really briefly recommend, because I don't want to dwell on it too much because it's not 90s, but if anyone does want to catch up on more kind of Asian horror, the next step should be The Eye, which was released in 2002 and is genuinely terrifying. Not the remake that had Jessica Alba in it, but the original one, which is legitimately terrifying. But I'll leave it at that because it's the wrong decade.
See, awesome. I'm scared already.
I've saw it in the cinema. The other one did get a cinema release in the UK, and I've never. There's a scene where I just basically pinned to my. I felt like I was pinned to my chair. Ooh. Like I was so scared.
Okay, watch that tonight.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to a report in the morning then, mate.
You have it. Don't worry about that.
Well, that's it. Thank you to Chris for joining us. It's been an absolute blast having you here. Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Please, can you tell the good listeners where they can find you and your work?
Yeah, you can. My day job is videogameschronicle.com. You can find my books on Amazon if you just search for Chris Scullion. And you can find me on Twitter at Scully1888. And if this chat about horror gets you excited, I also have a really bad horror website called thatwasabitmental.com, where I talk about weird and wonderful horror movies from all decades. And as we've been talking, I've just remembered that I never recommended Ghostwatch, and that's maybe something we could discuss another time. But
I watched Ghostwatch last October for Halloween.
Ghostwatch is my favourite thing of the 90s in general.
I'll book you in then, because my plan to cover that on a Halloween special.
Yeah, please do. Please bring me back for that, because that's one of my biggest obsessions. There was a period where I showed that in like pubs and kind of cinemas like on a yearly basis in both London and Edinburgh, because I'm obsessed with that. But that's for another time. But yeah, thank you very much for having me on. It was much appreciated.
No problem. Thank you to everyone for joining us. Don't forget, you can hear me and Rich talk video games with Andrew and Steve on Dreamcast Years podcast. And don't forget that Rich can also be found at the Dreamcast Junkyard. Mm-hmm. You can find these wonderful podcasts on Twitter at Dreamcast Years and at the DC Junkyard. Next time, we reach the movies of 1997. And with so many great films coming out in this year, we think we might split it into two parts. So please keep an eye out for part one of that in a couple of weeks' time. Chaps, it's time to say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye all.
Bye.
My name has been Jason. You've been listening to What's Wrong with Wolfie, 90s podcast to the max. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.
7 days.
What's wrong with Wolfie? I can hear him barking.